Sometimes we send instruments to the planets. Sometimes the planets come to us. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The advent of spacecraft which can return samples from other planetary bodies is a very new one, and the list of successful sample return missions remains very short. But pieces of asteroids, the Moon, and even other planets have been falling to Earth since the dawn of the solar system. Meteorites of lunar and Martian origin have been identified, and others have been connected to parent bodies in the asteroid belt. Such meteorites are a rich source of information about their places of origin, and may still be seen falling to Earth periodically, if only we watch and wait. Dr. Peter Brown is among those watching. He's a professor at Western University, where he holds a Canada Research Chair in Meteor Astronomy, and is director of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. His research group operates a network of sensors to monitor for meteors with a variety of detection techniques, aiming to better understand their composition, origin, and rate of occurrence, and to connect them with their place and history in the solar system. Western World's Alyssa Gilbert spoke to Dr. Brown recently about how to follow the trail of these rocky messengers from the birth of the solar system to their fall to Earth.
So you're, of course, a professor here at Western and the director of the CPSX. So maybe you could give us a bit of a background of how you got into your research area and kind of a brief history of your professional background.
I got into my research area, which is meteors and meteorites, as an amateur astronomer. So quite a long time ago. Basically, my interest in meteors evolved out of a broader interest in astronomy. So I was interested in astronomy, and I think I can say with confidence got interested or was brought to astronomy by a grade 4 teacher. So she was very keen on astronomy. That got me hooked, and within a few years of that, within 2 or 3 years, I specialized. So started doing meteors fairly young as an amateur astronomer and decided that was something I wanted to pursue professionally. And then that led to doing an undergraduate degree in physics, which I did at University of Alberta, and then a master's and a PhD in physics, which I did here at Western, and then went on to do a postdoc at Los Alamos National Labs in the US, and then came back here to Western, where I've been ever since as a professor.
Of course, here at Western, we have the media physics group, which is very known throughout the world, really, for meteor research and meteorite research. Dr. Margaret Campbell-Brown, we had on the show last season. She talked about her research. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what you and your graduate students work on in the group.
Within the meteor group, we study almost all aspects of solid objects interacting with the Earth. My interest actually covers primarily observational studies of meteors, meteoroids, and fireballs that can produce meteorites. I would say I'm a little more inclined towards larger objects, so fireballs and things that produce meteorites. So as a result, a lot of the work I do has to do with developing camera networks that detect brighter meteors, looking at radar observations from brighter meteors, listening to the sound waves from bright meteors, looking at detonations of meteors in the atmosphere, some satellites. So it's really a multi-technique kind of approach where we're trying to answer basic questions about how these objects interact with the Earth, where they come from, what they're made of, what effect they have on the Earth. And we do that by looking at all of these observational modes and then sort of put it all together to try to give us a complete picture.
And so, of course, we get a lot of public interest in this area, right? Because a lot of the times, if you have a large object, you have meteorites falling to the ground, and we do meteorite searches from here. I don't know if you can tell us a bit about those.
Sure, yeah. So one of the big science themes that I have is this idea of trying to sample different parts of the solar system and having a context for that sample. So in other words, if we have a meteorite on the ground and there are tens of thousands of known meteorites, there's an enormous amount of work you can do in the lab to understand what was the formation conditions for that meteorite, what sort of evolution it's undergone. But the piece that's almost always missing is where did that object come from? So the work we do tries to fill in that spatial context, that provenance, by recording the passage of these larger objects through the atmosphere as fireballs. So we work out their pre-atmospheric orbit around the sun, and then we go out and collect the object. So it's like a sample return mission where the sample comes to us. In a sense, anytime there's a bright fireball and meteorites might be found, we're very interested in trying to, you know, figure out where these things might be on the ground. So we operate a camera network of about 10 cameras, 10 sites here in southern Ontario. Every night that it's dark, whether it's clear or not, we're always recording, looking at the sky. Whenever there's a bright meteor, we are able to track that and measure its path in the atmosphere. And then based on how it behaves, we get some hint as to whether or not there might be rocks on the ground. And on average, once every year or two, we do get a pretty big event that produces something we think might result in rocks that could be recovered. And that's when we go out and try to do meteorite hunts. And we've done four or five meteorite hunts in the last decade or so. The most successful, of course, was one in 2009, where there's a meteorite found near Grimsby, Ontario, that our network recorded, and so we have an orbit for that, and we have the rocks on the ground. We've been studying the rocks here and learning an awful lot about this meteorite and where it comes from. So we're hoping to do that more frequently in the future.
And of course, that Grimsby one was turned into a National Geographic special, I believe.
Right, yeah. So Grimsby, the fireball, was unique in a couple ways. Certainly, it was among the brightest fireballs to have occurred anywhere in southern Ontario in the last 10 years, so it was pretty energetic. It was detected by our cameras, it was detected by our radar, it was detected by, we have a network of microphones that listens for the shockwaves from meteors called, these low-frequency shockwaves are called infrasound. The fireball was detected infrasonically, so we really had, for the first time, a huge number of different instruments that detected all of the passage of this object to the atmosphere, so we could really piece together in intricate detail exactly what happened. How big it was, how it broke up in the atmosphere. In many ways, Grimsby was, you could argue, the most well-documented meteorite fall in history because we have all these different techniques that saw it. And our goal is to do that again. You know, next time there's a meteorite fall, we'd like to have all these different technologies contribute to understanding of how the fireball passes through the atmosphere.
So you talked about how you can connect or really find the orbits of these objects and where they are possibly from in our solar system. So how hard is that process really? Because you're having these things come through the atmosphere, and obviously there's a lot of things that we don't really know about our atmosphere. How hard is it to make that orbit determination?
Well, the orbit determination ultimately is just a geometrical thing, right? The cameras give us sort of the triangulated angles, and we get timing from the video so we can work out the speed. So I don't want to say it's just high school geometry, but really that's sort of what's involved. So as long as we can get the cameras to make measurements from these different positions, in principle, you know, all the math is there to piece it together. The hard part is meteorite falls don't happen that often, so you have to watch for a long time. And of course, you know, it's cloudy, or, you know, it's daylight and meteorite falls occur, and so we don't get the optical registrations in those cases. So it's always trying to play off these different factors. And so it's a waiting game. You really have to wait a long time. We have had other meteorites that have fallen that we've detected. Another part of the puzzle is sometimes those falls occur in places where you aren't going to find anything, like the Great Lakes, for example, right? They fall into the lakes, or they fall someplace where it's not farmland. And so Grimsby was sort of a perfect storm in the sense of all these factors came together. It landed in a place where you could find things, there were people, you know, so you had a good chance of finding lots of meteorites. That's pretty rare. It's the rarity of being able to bring all this together that makes it hard to determine the orbit. If these were happening every day, we'd have thousands of orbits, right? We could do this frequently. But it's once every year or two now that somebody is able to document enough of a fireball that produces a meteorite to get an orbit. So it's pretty rare. There's only been about 20.
It's Speaking of which, there was one recently, the Sutter's Mill meteorite fall in California, which of course you were involved in as well as your one of your grad students, Elizabeth Silver. Could you tell us maybe why that fall was so unique?
This was a big sort of international consortium study. Sutter's Mill was a meteorite that fell in California, just outside of Sacramento, in April of last year, April of 2012. And it was unusual for several reasons. First of all, the meteorite itself was an unusual kind of relatively rare meteorite called a carbonaceous chondrite. Those don't happen very often. We don't get many falls of carbonaceous chondrites. Maybe once every decade do we get a fall of a carbonaceous chondrite. So that was pretty unusual. Recovering it fairly quickly allowed study of some organics and volatiles that otherwise would be contaminated from interaction with the terrestrial atmosphere. So that, again, was a real bonanza. But also, it was recorded by video, photographs, some radar measurements as well. So that sort of adds to the richness of the documentation of the fall, allowed us to trace back the orbit again, which was also very unusual. It was a very big orbit, took it out almost as far as Jupiter. So the meteorite itself, very interesting. You know, most of the 60 authors on the paper, I would say 55 of them probably, are all focused on the rock. You know, they're cosmochemists or petrologists in various ways. And that really, you know, speaks to the uniqueness of carbonaceous chondrites. But there were a number of us who looked at the, you know, how big was the object? Where did it come from? And again, it's very interesting. It looks like it came from the outer asteroid belt, very primitive material, the sort of thing that really hasn't been heavily altered since the early days of the solar system. Building blocks of the planets, building blocks of the Earth, and maybe even in terms of the organics, sort of giving us hints about prebiotic chemistry. So really interesting in that respect. Lots and lots of avenues for research. And, you know, there's many projects going on now looking at a kilogram or so of material from Sutter's Mill.
And from the looks of the orbit, when I saw the diagram, it immediately jumped to me that it might be a cometary body. Was there a discussion about that?
There's long-standing interest, and people have suggested, you know, could some meteorites be from comets? Most meteoriticists don't really think this is very likely, because particularly things like water alteration are not the sort of things you'd expect on the sort of primitive comets, at least in the way we think of them. But that doesn't rule it out. And you're right, the orbit is not unlike, or at least within air, the orbit would not be totally dissimilar to classic comets called Jupiter family comets. Now, nominally, the orbit is asteroidal, but again, within air, you could say maybe it is a Jupiter family comet. Certainly, the meteorite fall was unusual in that the speed of the fireball was very high, and that, again, is more consistent, or it hints more at sort of a cometary origin than a classical sort of asteroidal origin. So I would say, in some sense, the jury's still out on that. I certainly think mainstream thinking is it's almost certainly a meteorite from the outer parts of the asteroid belt, where those bodies probably in some ways represent comets, or at least they're starting to transition more toward what comets might be like.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of gets into the whole debate about, you know, what's an asteroid, what's a comet, and the transition objects between them, something I think you're familiar with. It's an interesting piece of that puzzle, but I think, you know, thinking of it as a, you know, Jupiter family comet, where those comets come from the Kuiper belt, right now is still probably a bit of a leap, but it's certainly not impossible.
And one of the other interesting things that came out of the study was the cosmic exposure age, which was, what,
50,000 years. Yeah. So that I didn't mention that earlier, but that probably was one of the most interesting aspects of this particular meteorite and the meteorite fall. It had a cosmic ray exposure age, which is the time period in which the object was sort of orbiting the sun as an independent meter-sized body. So it kind of represents the time at which it was knocked off of a larger parent and started making its way towards the Earth. Typical cosmic ray exposure ages for most stony meteorites are a few million to tens of millions of years. That's a sort of typical number. And that number reflects the dynamical pathways that objects get from the asteroid belt to the Earth. Those pathways typically take a few million to tens of millions of years, so you get knocked off in the main belt, you float around there for quite a long time, and then you interact with Jupiter, and then you get thrown inwards and can get hit by the Earth. In the case of Sutter's Mill, that 50,000 years is really short. There's really no way for these sort of normal mechanisms that deliver material from the main belt to operate, at least in a statistically reasonable sense. So it's telling you something about the parent body, that, you know, the orbit that you see now is not all that different from the orbit it would have had when it had gotten knocked off of the parent body. I mean, it certainly would have changed, but it's not dramatically different. Maybe the object it got knocked off of is already in your thought asteroid, which would be very interesting because we don't think most meteorites come from the immediate liberation of material from a near-Earth asteroid. Rather, they're material related to liberated in the main belt, and then independently they make their way towards the Earth. So that's very interesting. Or the object, the parent body, was right near one of these so-called resonance zones. The main belt got knocked off and the object got very quickly pumped up into Earth-crossing orbit. It's possible, though less likely, that happened. Either way, those are interesting scenarios.
Right, so the orbit that you calculated for this object is for itself, right? So is there any way to connect it back to an orbit of its potential parent body?
In principle, if you knew the orbit with high precision, and you know that the cosmic ray exposure age is pretty short, you could start making some statistical arguments by doing backward numerical integrations of the orbit and start saying things. An orbit is just the last sort of path that the object had through this crazy evolution from its start in the main belt to the Earth. And unfortunately, just because of chaos, going back very far, you don't get deterministic answers. You just get some statistical things. The nice thing about such a short cosmic ray exposure age is you might have a better chance of saying more constrained, still statistical, but more constrained things about where in the asteroid belt it came from. Possibly, again, if we could refine the orbit and get higher accuracy in the orbit, maybe even say something about the original likely asteroid. That's still probably stretching things at this point, but if you're ever going to do it, you're going to do it for an object with a low cosmic ray exposure age like Sutter's Mill. That's what makes it really exciting.
And is this low cosmic ray exposure age, is that typical of other carbonaceous chondrite meteorites, or is this atypical in general?
So there are some cosmic ray exposure ages for the other kinds of carbonaceous chondrites that are structurally like CM. So CIs and CMs are sort of similar. And yes, those, the other CMs do have relatively short ages, so a few hundred thousand years up to maybe just a few million years. That's very short compared to most stony cosmic ray exposure age times. There even seems to be a peak in the CM type carbonaceous chondrites, which is the type of meteorite that Sutter's Mill is, around 200,000 years. There's one or two that are, you know, 50 to 100,000 years, but Sutter's Mill is right on the extreme outer edge of that, right? It's very, very short. I think Sutter's Mill probably is in the top three or four shortest cosmic ray exposure ages of any meteorites ever measured. So it's really, really interesting. And because we have an orbit for it, it becomes that much more fascinating.
So I guess in terms of Sutter's Mill and future meteorite falls, what would be your wish for what would be the next thing to study?
Well, the things that I think would be interesting to look at are types of meteorites. We'd like to get orbits for types of meteorites we don't currently have orbits for. So an iron meteorite with an orbit would be very interesting. Certain kinds of rarer meteorites, like lunar or Martian meteorites, would be very interesting to have orbits for those because we have models for how those kinds of meteorites are delivered, and those models make predictions about the kinds of orbits you would expect. And so, of course, it would be very interesting to look at that and try to validate or at least constrain those models. It would be interesting to look at unusual fireball events. You know, I'm thinking in particular larger objects that produce craters would be interesting to look at. We don't get a lot of those. We had one a few years ago in Peru, but we probably won't see another one for quite some time. Although, again, irons can produce these. That's interesting because then you start getting effects on the ground that you can relate to, you know, flight through the atmosphere, that sort of thing. So I guess really it's a, you know, there's a continuum of questions from the dynamical linkages to the physical structure of the objects to their interaction with the atmosphere, right down to, you know, crater production. You know, how does that affect the geology of the Earth? Great to see that happening in action. You can learn an awful lot more about the whole process by seeing it in real time. Now, obviously, kilometer-sized or tens of kilometer-sized craters, I don't think any of us want to see in real time, but, you know, much smaller craters should happen reasonably often, as evidenced by this one in Peru in 2007. So more of those sorts of events, I think, would be interesting to look at and study the behavior of, you know, how do these objects, as they move through the atmosphere, what allows some to produce craters and others not.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us today, and I'm sure we'll be talking again with you in the future.
My pleasure. Been fun.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to the interview with Dr. Peter Brown, who is the CPSX director here at the University of Western Ontario, and he talked a lot about the Sutter's Hill meteorite, which fell in California,
months ago now, and since then there's been actually a couple other meteorite falls which we can talk about. But one of the interesting things he was talking about with this one is it's kind of one of the most recorded events, meteorite falls anyway, and that's why they were able to get such good data from it, from videos and stuff that people have been shooting.
Yeah, we're kind of coming into this age when there are a lot of people running around with cameras in their phones and wherever else, and we're connected enough that something that falls on one side of the planet is noticeable to people everywhere else.
Yeah, Twitter probably carries the news faster than the actual light, right?
Well, it certainly carries it faster than seismic waves, anyway. So Sutter's Mill is a great example of being able to catch things in action, but we're starting to see that there's a lot of these things.
Yeah, it seems like lately people are paying a little bit more attention, maybe. There have been a couple big ones in the news, and all of a sudden it seems like there are way more arriving, but really it's just people noticing a little bit more.
Yeah, I think we're watching better, and it's making the news more.
Yeah. But...
Well, although, I mean, the one in Russia was of notable...
Yes.
Size.
That
right?
was, yeah. Well, that was basically the biggest in a century.
Yeah. It was about 17 meters or something in size.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, Peter Brown's group that did the analysis on that.
Yeah, in fact, they've done a lot of work on that meteorite, trying to find out the size of it, speed, angle, all that kind of stuff. And now they're trying to work on finding its orbit and where did it come from and really why didn't we see it coming?
What's the size that they're estimating now?
17 meters.
Yeah. And they're a little bigger than the first estimates.
Yeah, initially I think it was around 10 or 12 or something.
Something like that.
Yeah,
we really only detected it when it hit the atmosphere. Like, we had no warning.
Yeah, no, that's right. When it started flaming down through the sky and making a mess, that's when we noticed it. Which is a little late.
It's awfully late. It could have done
luckily,
far worse.
Luckily, the angle was at such a shallow angle through the atmosphere that it didn't actually do much damage, right? It exploded in the sky, didn't actually hit anything. There was, about 1,000 people who were injured, but no one died, and there wasn't not any major damage. You know, but I've seen calculations where if it were at a steeper angle, there would have been considerable
damage. I mean, there were a couple of buildings essentially destroyed.
Yeah.
There was a roof collapse. It was pretty impressive to watch some of the videos, and you could see the windows explode.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not just like a light shattering. Those things exploded. Yeah.
It's remarkable how much secondary damage can happen even when the thing doesn't hit the ground in mass.
Mm-hmm.
Some fragments, of course, fell to the earth, but really most of it's just coming from the pressure wave.
Yeah, and what's amazing about that one is, I mean, Peter Brown was talking about the Grimsby meteorite fall in 2009, I think, mm-hmm. here, about how many videos and stuff there was of that. I mean, you look at this Russian one, I mean, there are hundreds of videos.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to him.
Thank goodness for dash cam.
Yeah, I was talking to him the other day, and he said they're probably going to get upwards of 1,000 videos.
Yeah, and it was
talking
like too much.
About you have so much data there.
And it was all over YouTube within hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I heard about it.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't hear about it from CBC or any other news source. It was
on Wikipedia first before those guys.
Facebook and Twitter.
That's right.
It's
we live in a time when we can have that much data. Like Dr. Brown has his network of cameras all over southern Ontario. None of them caught this, right? Because it was on the wrong side of the planet.
Right.
But all those Russian dash cams.
Yeah. His infrasound caught it, though.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
From this all the way across?
All the way across. In fact, I was watching, there was a NOVA special about this meteorite called Meteorite Strike, or Meteor Strike or something. They were talking about how the seismic wave actually went around the world a number of times and was recorded over and over and over again.
And this is a small object. Much bigger ones have hit.
They guess it's about 470 kilotons of TNT. It's about 15 to 20 for the Hiroshima bomb.
Oof.
So it's about 20 times of energy as the first atomic bomb.
And it's all like thermal energy and explosion and kinetics. It's not exactly
a reaction.
No.
It's not radiation, thankfully.
Yeah.
It's just,
if that gets deeper in the atmosphere, right? What was the name of the one that exploded also over Russia and Siberia?
Tunguska.
Tunguska.
1909, was it?
So
that one was, I think, roughly the same size, right? And that was the biggest one
anyone has seen.
That one got much further down, apparently.
Yeah, and like flattened the forest.
But again, it was an airburst, and it did an enormous swath of damage. Similar, actually, it seems like these airbursting meteors seem to prefer Russia, which is...
and we talk about Well, Russia's a big place.
So is Canada. What's wrong with us?
Canada has been hit before.
We've got a lot of holes in Canada for that. Yeah.
But you know, people talk about how the risk of meteorite strikes. It's one of these 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000 years. And sure, for objects of large enough size to make noticeable craters, but neither of these made a crater, right? They just blew up in the atmosphere. A few little bits of rock maybe fell to the ground. Nonetheless, Tunguska flattened forest for some 100 kilometers wide, and then this one is smashing glass all over the place. Yeah.
And they're only a couple tens of meters across.
Yeah, that's right.
We always talk about the big ones being a kilometer or 10 kilometer in size, and yeah, those are going to do serious global damage. But I mean, these things, I mean, if either of them, well, specifically this one, because it was above a city,
if
it got any lower or was at a higher angle, I mean, it could have destroyed that entire city.
And this starts to look like it's not a once in a very, very long time.
No, this size of thing can happen fairly frequently. And because it's frequent, that means, you know, the statistics become a little bit more irrelevant. Yes, it could happen, you know, there could be two in one day.
Of course, But, you know, two of them a century apart starts to be the kind of thing that I would like to have a defense against.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government recently brought Bolton and NASA head to talk to them about what the sort of preparation is. And he told them, well, you told us to do things in the past, but the funding was never there. So if something large was spotted, what could we do about it? And what he said was pray. Right. Yeah. So like we really don't, like we can talk about hypotheticals, but
we
do not have
ideas.
The technology. Ideas, but that's it.
Yeah.
We do not have the ability to deflect anything large. And we don't even apparently have the ability to spot things that can do substantial amounts of damage.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much anything under a kilometer, you can't really see, right?
Yeah, they get a little under that. A couple hundred meters is reasonable now.
And we can do it. I mean, it's doable. Yeah. We could spot something this size. We have more funding for it, right?
Right.
They're not visible.
And they've done a survey down to like, I think it's on the order of 100 or 200 meters now that they've covered.
Yeah.
I think they estimate they've got 90% of those now.
Right.
Which is still like,
there's still quite
10%.
But I mean, you think about how many more objects. I mean, because obviously you have more objects if they're smaller, right? So
yeah, and these are 10-meter objects, not 100-meter objects. So and those they're harder to detect, and you know, so.
But like you said, it's not an issue of whether we can detect them or not. It's having the infrastructure and the funding there for
it. It's not even the technology. I mean,
there are some pretty reasonable
ideas that are not that far outside of the technology we have on how to deflect or defend against these. But it's having the infrastructure in place and having someone who says, yes, it's my job to go and do that, and I have the budget to do it, and I have the spacecraft or the facility to do it. That certainly does not exist at this
time. Yeah, I find that just crazy. I mean, here we are. We're a pretty advanced species. You know, we've got the capabilities. We've got the knowledge that's required, and we just can't get off our butts to take care of this thing.
And if you need a warning
sign,
I think we've received it.
Yeah. Well, we've got it many times, right?
You know, one at the start of the 20th century and another one at the start of this month.
Yeah.
Yeah, we understand the statistics of how often these things are going to hit. We understand lots of stuff, and yet don't do anything about it.
It's it is, of course, actually difficult to organize human activities.
Yeah.
But we got no excuse.
Yeah, it's a little too important to just say, we'll get to it later.
You know, for very large calamities, you could imagine a real problem. Even for something just a little bigger than what happened in Russia this winter.
Yeah, it wouldn't take much more.
Yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, David Kirsch, and Parshati Patel. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFN, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight, and I hope you can make world enough in time to join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.